Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, as always brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. So if this is your first time with the podcast, what we do over here is we watch every single film in the collective Coppola family filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time? This is episode 34, and I'm not alone on this one. I've got a guest, as I always do, and I have the absolute bloody pleasure of being joined by the Duke of Spook himself, the Prince of Darkness, Mike Muntzer from the fantastic, possibly best in the game podcast, The Evolution of Horror. If you're not aware of Mike, you've really been living under a rock. But it was great fun to have him on this conversation to talk about a bit of a curio in the kind of 90s kind of horror thriller genre, and it's very much a product of its time. And it's, yeah, we get into all of that, and it's a Dimensions film, so there's all of that to talk about, and it's a lot of fun. So I very much hope you enjoy this chat. All of the spoiler warnings do apply. We talk about all the grisly deaths and all the spooky moments within this film, so be warned before stepping any further. Join us as we begin our night shift at the morgue, start to lose our minds because of the strange goings on, and get ourselves embroiled in a murder case as we make some Coppola connections. We're here today as I take up my new job as a night watchman. We discuss O.E. Barndow's 1997 horror thriller Night Watch. The film stars Ewan McGregor, Josh Brolin. I wrote James Brolin. Maybe that is a bit of a Freudian slip for the character's name. Nick Nolte, Lauren Graham, Brad Dourif, John C. Reilly, and today's Coppola connection, Patricia Arquette. Joining me to either prove this film's innocence and see if it alone warrants the Coppolas the title of the greatest film family of all time, or if we should frame them for crimes against cinema, is somebody well-versed in the world of all things horror. I have the absolute pleasure of being joined by the host of the phenomenal Evolution of Horror podcast, Mike Muntzer. How are you today, Mike?
Hello, I'm really good, thank you. Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm very well. Yeah. I've just got over like an illness, so on the podcast, it's probably going to be like 3 weeks where I sound really ill, where it's just episodes were recorded in very quick succession.
Yeah, I know that feeling. Yeah.
Yeah, like, wow, he was ill for a long time. Like, in all fairness, I was ill for maybe 5 days tops. Before we get into talking about the Coppola family, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about evolution of horror. And yeah, could you explain to us what evolution of horror is, Mike?
Yeah, so Evolution of Horror is it's a horror film discussion podcast, basically. So I started it about 3 years ago. We go through the sort of the history of the horror genre from its like origins, from kind of early cinema all the way through to now. Each week I'm joined by a different guest who joins me to discuss a different horror film and its kind of place in the horror history. And the podcast is kind of split into seasons where we focus on different subgenres. So we did a series on slasher movies, and then we did a series on zombie movies and ghost movies and all that kind of thing. So that's sort of how it works. And it's a hell of a lot of fun because I just get to talk to very cool people about films I love. So it's amazing.
Perfect. I was kind of scouring through your back catalogue, trying to see if there's any like kind of crossover, if there's any Coppolas or Cages that might have cropped up. And the only thing I can think of is something that might be coming up in your like upcoming season on vampires with Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. Is that one that will be discussed on the podcast?
Absolutely, that will be discussed. Yeah. That's a good point. Other than that, I'm not sure. I'm trying to think if there's any other connection. The thing about a lot of horror films is that they tend to be pretty small movies and they don't have a lot of big names attached to them a lot of the time. So you don't get a lot of the sort of the Coppola dynasty involved in a lot of horror films.
Yeah. Sophia hasn't yet done like a horror about the plights of middle class rich Americans yet. It depends. If you could look at The Bling Ring and maybe like shoehorn it in to be a horror about what it's like to be a star having all of your stuff stolen by a group of teenagers. It's kind of a home invasion film, I guess.
I mean, it's pretty horrific in places, isn't it? Is it Sofia Coppola as well that did The Beguiled, where they have to like saw off Colin Farrell's leg and stuff. I mean, there's a bit of good gruesome body horror in that, you know?
Yeah, I guess that's like a Southern Gothic, at least. It's kind of flirting with the idea of horror. And I guess Nicolas Cage, again, is somebody who has flirted with like the kind of genre. And I know that there was a film that probably would have been perfect for your mind and like body horror season, which I guess you rightfully left off. For obvious reasons, I'm sure regular listeners of the podcast will know why that was left off.
Which one are you talking about? Is it Mandy?
Color Out of Space.
Yeah. There is a reason why I left that one off. And yeah, I mean, of course, I suppose Nick Cage, he has done a lot of horror movies, hasn't he? He's done, you know, the Wicker Man remake, Mandy, a whole bunch of stuff. So I guess he's the sort of biggest connection to the genre. You're gonna wanna throw me off your podcast immediately when I say this, but I'm not the biggest Nicolas Cage fan, and that's the reason why I haven't really covered a lot of his movies on my podcast.
That's fine. You have Brad Hansen kind of flying the flag whenever opportunity arises on your podcast. That's absolutely fine.
That's right. And I did think Mandy was actually a really interesting film. I did cover that one. Interviewed Panos Cosmatos on the podcast as well, who was really great, really interesting. And that film has a lot of beautiful, wonderful elements about it as well, which I loved. So yeah. I do think, for the record, Nick Cage is an excellent actor. I just sometimes wish he was in better films, you know. Yes. I really do.
Yeah. As somebody who's watched all of his films, I can nothing but agree with you on that point. I'm kind of I'm there like a parent watching their child play football badly, being like, I'm supporting you, but I wish you did better.
I know, come on, man. I mean, I Wild at Heart, and like, let's bring back that era of Nick Cage, you know. But anyway, that's a different conversation.
Well, let's talk about your Coppola credentials. And I always like to ask my guests, first of all, like, when they first became aware of the Coppolas. But by that, it's like, what was your entry point by a person? And then when did you realize that they were such a massive family?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think, I was probably a teenager just kind of really falling in love with cinema in like a real kind of diehard way when I was going back and sort of reading about the auteurs and watching the movies that everyone says you have to watch. I remember there was a time when I, you know, discovered Stanley Kubrick and I discovered, you know, David Lynch and then I discovered the Godfather movies. And I don't know, there's probably at some point earlier in my life that I had maybe caught some sort of Nick Cage film or whatever else, but I can't remember. But the first time of really being aware of a Coppola is The Godfather, I think. And kind of, I did that in sort of, I think I even studied it at school. And so watching those films was kind of a real eye-opener. And then, of course, discovering that when I was a teenager, I was watching movies like The Virgin Suicides and stuff like that, and kind of realizing that there was this connection, that there was this family, I suppose. And to be honest, a lot of it comes as a huge surprise to me as to who is connected to the Coppola family. Like, when you first sent me the list of films to discuss on this podcast, I was like, what? Because some of them I had no idea. And again, I have to admit, I didn't even know that Patricia Arquette was in any way connected to this family as well. So, like, I'm still learning. This is all still new to me.
She's one of the more tenuous. So there's a couple of, like, tenuous ones. And I hate to do, like, I know it's horrible to speak about people in relation to who they're married to, but I just wanted an excuse to talk about, especially a very interesting era of Patricia Arquette's career through, like, the 90s and that period that she was married to Nicolas Cage. So I guess it would have been a couple of years before this till 2001. So yeah, I get to cover this. I get to cover the great David Lynch film Lost Highway. I get to cover Stigmata, and also get to cover Lady and the Tramp too. So
amazing! All the classics, all the greats. What about True Romance? Was that too early? Was that before that, she was?
That was too early. But I think that was around the time, because she tells a really fascinating story about, like, how she was courted by Nicolas Cage, and she kind of. He was like kind of, she was dating somebody else at the time, and he kind of, like, you imagine him, like, especially in the late 80s, early 90s, kind of very much in Sailor Ripley mode, like leather jacket and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Kind of said to her, like, one day I'm going to marry you. And she said, well, I'll marry you if you can kind of collect these items. Kind of sent him on a quest. Like, one of them was like an original, like, Edgar Allan Poe writing. It was all like really weird stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like a raven's feather. It was really like fantasy Amazing. Movie stuff. And he did it all. And then she was like, well, I guess I'm marrying Nicolas Cage then.
Incredible. Incredible. And I suppose the Arquette family in itself as well. Another quite big, famous kind of dynasty in acting and film, right? As well. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, there is these kind of weird crossovers when you get to, like, I guess Angelica Houston has been in like a Francis Ford Coppola film, and then is in all of the Wes Anderson films, who, like, in a weird way, Wes Anderson feels like he's kind of like the weird stepson of the Coppola family. Because when you start looking at Jason Schwartzman and Roman Coppola's involvement in those films, it's like, and then Spike Jones, like, his career doesn't really happen without the marriage to Sophia, and Francis Ford Coppola giving him the script to be in John Malkovich and being like, hey, I know you're making skate movies and stuff like that, but I reckon you should direct this script. And then it's like, boom, we don't get everything else off the back of that.
All that incredible stuff. It's true. Spike Jones, one of my favorite filmmakers as well, actually. Some really interesting stuff there. Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. What an amazing, sprawling family tree this is. It's great.
Was there anyone in particular on that list who you kind of, like, scratched your head or, like, surprised you the most that they're kind of related and kind of, like, were like, how are they involved with the family?
Again, like I said, I have such poor knowledge of, like, my partner is always kind of mocking me for, I never know anything about celebrities. I barely know anything about actors. I never know who's married to who, who's related to who. So most of these names, to be honest, are a shock to me that they are in any way related to the fact. I didn't know Jason Schwartzman. I didn't know Lisa Marie Presley. Like, all of these, like, various names all come as a surprise to me, to be honest. I think I knew Sophia, Nick Cage, and Francis Ford Coppola, and that's about it. So, yeah, what a task you've got in working your way through all of these.
Yeah, I think I'll be doing it for the next 3 years at least. And I'm hoping some guests in the future pick some of the lesser known family members, because I have a feeling otherwise that the final stretch of this podcast will be just me mopping up the straight to VOD dross that is kind of out there, the stuff of wavering quality at least.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So, Mike, you obviously have worked in like the kind of the peripheries of film, kind of journalism and doing the podcast, stuff like that. Have you ever had the opportunity to meet a Coppola at all?
That is a good question. I don't think I have. I was just trying to remember whether I've ever met Patricia Arquette, because I've done a lot of... I worked for the BBC for several years and basically interviewed pretty much everyone that was publicising a film from week to week. We did the... I produced the sort of flagship BBC One film programme where we would go and basically, yeah, do all the press interviews for every movie coming out. And I definitely went to the press junket for Boyhood, but I don't think she was there at the time, or I don't think I got to interview her. The rest of the cast I did. And who else is that? Definitely never met Nick Cage. I'd remember that. And I've never met Jason Schwartzman. I don't think I have, you know. I don't think I have. It would be awesome, wouldn't it? What a treat to get to meet some of these people. Like something about Patricia Arquette is ringing a bell. Like maybe at some point I might have interviewed her for like a minute on a red carpet or something. Uh-huh. But nothing that really kind of sticks in the mind. Nothing particularly. No good stories to tell. Sadly.
My favorite one of the answers for this was somebody who was like, "I saw Phantom Planet back in the day. Does that count?" And I was like, "Yeah, I guess being in the same room as Jason Schwartzman as he drums and they play California definitely counts as kind
perfect.
Of breathing the same air as a Coppola, at least.
That'll do, yeah, absolutely.
So, Mike, what would have been your introduction to Patricia Arquette on screen?
Well, I think it was True Romance, actually. That was, I had older siblings and I was kind of introduced to quite a lot of kind of more adult movies, I guess, quite early on. And I remember seeing a lot of the Tarantino movies when I was probably way too young to be watching those sorts of films. I was in primary school and I was quite disturbed by some of the violence in some of these movies, I remember. But I really liked True Romance and I remember really liking Patricia Arquette and Christian Slater in it. I think that was my sort of first introduction to her. And then, like I say, I became a real horror fan in the 90s, in the late 90s, particularly kind of following the success of movies like Scream. And then that kind of wave of horror movies that followed Scream in the late 90s, all made by sort of Miramax, Dimension Films, those kind of things. And Nightwatch was one of those movies, right? That was like one of their titles. And I definitely sought out Nightwatch and watched it when I was young in the 90s, in that kind of boom of 90s horror. So that and True Romance were probably my first two movies of Patricia Arquette. And then definitely, what's it called? Stigmata as well. Yep. Stigmata.
I thought you were going to say, of course, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And that's that as well. Like, I can't remember whether or not I saw that before or after Nightwatch. It would have been around the same time because it was during my kind of horror awakening. It was when I was discovering all of the classics for the first time in the middle of that kind of 90s wave of horror. So it would have been around that exact same time as well, actually. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, it feels like the perfect time to talk about Nightwatch. But before we do, let's listen to the trailer, especially the trailer from 1987, which gives us a flavor of what horror was like at that time.
Martin Bells was a full-time student who needed a nighttime job.
How could you give away all your nights without talking to me first?
It's a test. I'm testing myself.
You don't think it's weird?
I have a pretty high tolerance to that sort of thing.
But he just accepted the wrong one.
A 17-year-old girl was found dead this evening, the third in as many weeks and the sixth in the last 2 months.
I saw her in the hallway.
Now, a series of murders have invaded his life.
I've interrogated murders like this one before. Let me tell you, they are well beyond the need to justify what they do. They just do it.
They have a suspect. It's me.
Boy, they got the wrong guy.
He didn't do it. Martin is not a murderer.
I think someone is trying to frame me.
Martin, if this is what I think it is, there's someone very dangerous standing right behind you in the dark, breathing down your neck.
Cool fact.
A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ewan McGregor, Patricia Arquette, Josh Brolin, and Nick Nolte.
Tell me something, Martin. Are you still going to maintain your innocence?
Nightwatch.
So, Nightwatch was released on home video in the UK in October 1998. As I said in the intro, it is directed by Owe Bondal and written by, well, adapted at least by Owe Bondal from his original script of Danish language, with the help of Steven Soderbergh, which is really fascinating. And
Soderbergh never above making a bit of a schlocky thriller every now and then, you know, he loves it.
Yeah, I heard recently somebody discuss Steven Soderbergh and saying what's fascinating about him is every single film he does, especially when it's in like a kind of the genre trappings, it seems like he just loves that genre, whether he's doing like Kimmy, his newest film, which kind of like is the paranoid kind of almost like the bastard child of Blowout and The Conversation, to bring it back to Francis Ford Coppola, with a bit of Rear Window thrown in, or whether he's doing like Unsane or something like that. It's all kind of, you just go, oh, right. And then he's doing Magic Mike and it's like, yeah, he just loves cinema. And I guess you see that when you see there's that fascinating, is it Sight Unseen, that list he does every year where it's just everything he's been watching and ingesting throughout the year and stuff like that. He's kind of, he'll watch the big stuff, he'll watch the small stuff, high art, low art, he'll have it all.
Yeah.
So what were your initial thoughts when you watched this back in the day, Mike? How did it catch you?
I loved it back in the day. This was a real favourite of mine. I remember finding it really genuinely scary and twisted and disturbing. Again, I watched this. I think I watched it when it was basically new out on video, which would have meant I was 10 years old. So I was quite young to be watching this movie about murdered sex workers. But I watched it, loved it. Thought the suspense was great. I thought some moments of it really chilled me. And I have kind of good memories of this movie in general. And then the older I've got, the kind of more I've realised, how well has this aged, I wonder, you know? And obviously, like you say, it's the director, Ole Borndal, he remade his own movie from 1994, Danish movie. And it's generally thought of as a pretty inferior remake. I suppose kind of like, but generally, and we'll talk about what we thought of it this time around, but I generally, my memories of it at the time were really good. It really kind of felt like it was cashing in on that wave of 90s slasher movies, where you've got all of these young hot stars that appear on the poster. You've got a murderer. You've got an almost whodunit. Like, who is the killer in this group of characters? So it's got that kind of Scream, Dimension Film, Kevin Williamson kind of cachet. And then it's also cashing it. Then it also feels a bit Seven and a bit Silence of the Lambs. And it's a bit procedural thriller, you know, slightly more quote unquote classy than a slasher movie, right?
Of course,
it isn't at all. But but it kind of feels like it's sort of straddling both those subgenres in a way and trying to appeal to kind of both audiences. And yeah, at the time, I thought it did a great job of that.
Well, from doing some research, and I tried to track it down, but it seems to be quite hard to get hold of. This had like an original over two hour cut of the movie, which kind of has an entire subplot all about Josh Brolin and Lauren Graham's character, about them kind of like the troubles with their engagement and stuff like that. And I know that the intro as well, that kind of that opening sequence we get of like this almost De Palma-esque like POV shot of like a murder taking place that's quite gruesome, like didn't get put into the film till like kind of post-production. I think like this is a film like many films of the 90s and moving forward that had the horrible chop from Hollywood's two most biggest bastards, really, the Weinstein brothers, right?
Yeah, definitely. Like, there's a lot of movies made by them where you can feel their chopping. You can feel their Edward Scissorhands, like, let's slice this up and add this and add this. And yeah, and you could see why maybe they thought at the time, again, in the wake of movies like Scream, stick a murder in the opening scene. Let's get rid of some of the kind of relationship nuances, amp up the gore, amp up the sex, and kind of see what we end up with, I suppose. And what we end up with is quite a sleazy, grimy sort of, I still think, quite fun in places and still quite creepy in places, but also it is, everyone in it is so reprehensible that it does kind of leave a bit of a horrible taste in your mouth by the end, I think, this movie, you know?
Definitely. And before we get into the things that we like and dislike about this film, can you tell us what the plot of this movie is, Mike?
Sure, yeah. So it's, again, on paper, I think this plot is awesome. That this guy called Martin, played by Ewan McGregor, he's a student, and he gets a job for a bit of extra cash as a night watchman in a morgue. So that in itself is a scary premise, right? So his job is literally to sit all night in this dark office and just keep an eye that nothing awry happens, basically, in this room full of dead bodies. And I think every hour throughout his shift, he has to like do the rounds and go around each room in the morgue, and he has to kind of press these buttons and turn these keys just to prove that he's done the rounds. And meanwhile, while this is happening, a serial killer is on the loose who is killing sex workers and potentially molesting their bodies as well, right? Their dead bodies. And these two threads start to intertwine as Martin, played by Ewan McGregor, suddenly starts to realize that someone else is in that morgue and is doing things to these dead bodies while he's on his night shift. And in the words of Nick Nolte in that trailer is, he's breathing down his neck in the dark. Like, and so there's all of these kind of great moments with Ewan McGregor just kind of in this dark, creepy place surrounded by dead bodies, and you don't quite know if someone else is in there with him. And then there's all this other stuff too about his relationship with his best friend, played by Josh Brolin, who's a complete tosser, and the way in which they treat women and the way in which they treat sex workers. And then that starts to have an effect on his relationship with his partner, played by Patricia Arquette. And then it also kind of inadvertently turns him into a suspect in this whole murder case, basically. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
That's perfect. Yeah, it's a fascinating kind of I don't know, film about, and you're saying like the other things that are thrown into the film, like one of the things that, even watching it again now, I was kind of taken aback by, even going like, what is that about, is the bin bags on the walls that just like just seem to be put there to just be like, well, let's just make that terrifying. And it's like, I have no idea what it's all about. Like,
honestly, I really think this is 50% a brilliant horror film. And I almost wonder, you know, in this day and age, you'd almost imagine a movie being made for Netflix that was a bit like this, made by somebody like Mike Flanagan, maybe, that is just a man in a morgue on his own overnight, right? Yes. And none of that other bollocks like that surrounds it. And it's just a sort of suspense play almost, right? And I think those moments in this film are still excellent. Like you say, that amazing production design where they've just put like, I think what it is like loads of trees that they've put bin bags over, right? So when the wind blows at night, they all kind of like, the bags are all moving. So you can see what looks like figures moving in the background all the time. And there's this weird device where in Ewan McGregor's office, there's this red light that will go off if a cord is pulled above any of the dead bodies, i.e. if any of the dead bodies wake up and pull this emergency cord, this huge red, this ominous red light will suddenly go off. And of course, that happens at some point in the movie. And I think there are a lot of really cool horror devices and elements in this. And I think that the stuff that happens in the morgue at night is still excellent, you know?
So, like, what would you kind of say, like, are the kind of big horror influences on this? Because I've seen some people say, like, there is, like, a giallo, like tint to the film. Would you see that at all in the kind of the way this is put together?
Yeah, 100%. Especially, like you said, the opening scene, you know, you think of De Palma, but you do also think of giallo, the knife, the blood, you know. There is an operatic element to this movie with the murders, I think, that certainly makes it feel quite giallo-esque. And then there's definitely a slasher movie element too, right? You know, and I suppose those two are kind of linked. You know, slashers kind of wouldn't have existed, you know, arguably without giallo. And I think there is a definite influence from, like I say, that the 90s slashers in particular. Even though the original Danish movie came before Scream, this movie feels like a movie that was made in the wake of the success of Scream. And so I think there's that kind of body count element. And then, you know, whether you call it horror, but that sort of Silence of the Lambs, that Seven, that procedural, that there was also this kind of wave of 90s, early 90s prestigious thrillers, right?
Yeah.
Erotic thrillers too. And I think this kind of owes a debt to those. So Basic Instinct, Fatal Attraction, Sliver, and all of those movies as well. I think this has also got an element of that to it as well, like almost a kind of not as good version of a kind of Paul Verhoeven movie or something, because there is something quite sleazy about this as well, you know. So I think it's got all of those elements kind of in a boiling pot.
Yeah, I think the reason I kind of I'm drawn to De Palma might be that I'm currently covering De Palma on like a Patreon season. So like, for me, he is kind of like the American Dario Argento, basically. They're both kind of borrowing from Hitchcock. And I just wanted to talk about that opening sequence, because it really is like you can tell why it's in the film, because it really does kind of grab you by the throat and make you sit up in your chair, like with the POV shot kind of like floating around the room.
Yeah.
The ceiling fan, you've got like the sex worker kind of seems into whatever's going on, and then it like it takes a turn for the dark, and then
just
that ceiling fan coming down and taking out the bird. I was like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah, it's quite a powerful opening scene, actually, isn't it? I really like it. And of course, you're right. I mean, De Palma, all of these go back to Hitchcock. And of course, it also really goes back to the film that was, you know, really kind of dismissed at the time, that came out the same year as Psycho, which was Peeping Tom. It's almost the same opening as Peeping Tom, where you've got this point of view shot from the killer as this sex worker invites him into her flat, and then he murders her brutally, you know. So it definitely is drawing on all that great kind of tradition of, you know, slashy, stabby kind of thriller movies. And it is, you know, for a movie, for a scene like you said that was kind of added in at the last minute in post-production, it is quite a chilling opening scene. And that the combination of the sort of mood it creates with some of those quite weird shots to that ceiling fan coming down, and like you say, the bird and everything, it is. And even through the opening credits sequence, which again feels a bit like the opening credits of something like Seven or something. I think the movie creates quite a good vibe, doesn't it? It creates quite a good atmosphere in that first sort of 5-10 minutes.
Well, what I love about it is like the score for this film kind of really just encapsulates whatever it wants to do at any moment as well. So like, it's kind of like, it's like, we got to remember we're in the 90s, so sometimes it's like boom chicka boom chicka boom chicka.
Yeah.
And then like there's like loads of needle drops, but then other times it's kind of high tension, high drama, giallo strings and stuff like that, and it's kind of takes you aback a bit. So I guess one of the things I wanted to discuss is maybe that's, yeah, that subplot we get with Martin and James, like, and how this film, because it's from like moment one, we're told as an audience, right, that James is one you should be looking at. James is, because like, yeah, all of the stuff he says, like, just really bizarre and kind of like, do you know what I mean? Like, just, yeah, a bit odd. Like,
yeah, they are quite horrible characters, aren't they? That these two sort of central male characters. Martin, you know, who is our sort of good guy, played by Ewan McGregor. He is our sort of hero. But even he is not a very nice, likable character, is he? I mean, I don't know whether maybe he was supposed to be in 1998, but he doesn't really come across well in watching it again in 2022, I don't think. And they've got this weird thing. It's almost like that kind of, what's it called? That sort of Nietzschean sort of Übermensch kind of complex where they're looking for this kind of thrill. It's almost like they are bored with their life. Mm-hmm. They want to find something that can make life interesting. They're looking for a challenge, basically. They're the ultimate kind of privileged, toxic men who feel like they've done everything. Everything that they want is for them on a plate. And they're bored, so they're wondering how they can push themselves, right? They both have these girlfriends who they treat really appallingly. Mm-hmm. And they go through this kind of challenge throughout the film where they try and push themselves to do different things. And that includes sleeping with a sex worker or doing this or doing that. It's kind of interesting on paper. Like, I think that, you know, you could look at this movie as actually being about toxic masculinity, right? This whole film really is about men and the way they treat women, even when, you know, we'll get to it, but even when it comes to the killer, right, and how he treats these sex workers and these dead bodies and everything else, and what he wants and whether he wants to stop but he can't and all this. And you feel like that it's all about these men with god complexes almost, right? And that in itself is interesting. I don't think that the film, and maybe that's because, like you said, loads of that stuff might have been cut. And because of that, it all feels a bit half-baked. And this is the stuff that I think doesn't come across very well, because you spend time with these horrible men who you don't really like. It doesn't really feel like it's saying much. And then because the female characters are so sort of quite thinly drawn, it doesn't really feel like it's doing enough with that theme. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I wish that I could say that that stuff was left on the cutting room floor. But from reading about the original, apparently, like, this version is toned down in its kind of misogyny and stuff like that. So, like, that is one of the saving graces from this one. So I'm not sure if that kind of exploration of toxic masculinity, like the deeper exploration at least, was in the original text to begin with. But, like, I really like that aspect of it. And one of the things you find throughout the film as well is Martin keeps talking about himself like as if he is the lead in a film. There's this kind of post Tarantino self-awareness, whether it's the kind of conversation that they have about pop culture and like, would you rather watch a movie like about an action adventure for an hour and a half, or do you like it for half the movie it's that, and then it's one guy and then it's him reading a book for I think later on in the film he's talking to Cray, I think it is, and he's like, oh, if I was he refers to himself as the hero. He's like, if I was the hero in the story, like this would go things would go differently. And I find that really fascinating, that like, obviously that kind of speaks somewhat to that kind of god complex and that kind of like, for Martin, he is like the lead of his, like everyone in their life is the lead of his own story. But like the way that he has this weird detached element about it and kind of like, talks about, and yeah, and the challenges they do, and like, I don't know, I think it makes for some of the more distressing like real world moments in the film. Like, obviously you can detach yourself from the idea of being embroiled in a plot with like a serial killer, but like the stuff in regards to like in the bar and stuff like that, and the way that like that you're saying, like, yeah, they treat their girlfriends like shit, like when Josh Brolin says to Lauren Graham's character, like, oh, we're going to stay. She's like, no, we're not. And she's like, oh, no, I wasn't talking about us. Let's talk about me and Martin. We're going to stay here and drink. Yeah. And then proceed. And then, then it goes on to that fight that he has. And just wanted to, like, to kind of show the listeners kind of what James is like. I pulled a clip of him and Martin speaking in the car, and you kind of you get that aspect that the filmmakers are definitely trying to do, that he could be the killer as well.
Definitely.
Back there at the bar, you were excited, but it was a rush. You felt good. You felt alive, didn't you?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, Lucy, I didn't feel anything. Nothing. But a year ago, I would have felt like you. I would have felt hyped up, flushed. But it's like my tolerance is increasing, and I can't get that feeling anymore, Martin. And I have to get that feeling. You just don't get that feeling, and I need it.
Yeah, I have to, too.
Yep.
Hey. Challenge me.
So yes, spoiler alert ahead that James isn't the killer, but even if he's not, he is definitely a sociopath, right?
He absolutely is, yeah. And one of the tricky things again about the film, and I don't know whether, in some ways, like you said, if the original, and I've seen the original a long time ago and I remember it being really similar, but the original has more misogyny in it. Sometimes that can help in that it can hammer home a bit more how abhorrent it is. Whereas yes, with this movie, because it's done with a lighter touch, it's more difficult to get a grasp of that. And the scene that is really uncomfortable for several reasons is when he hires the sex worker to come and sit at a restaurant with Martin, right? And James sort of watches on from another table and laughs as this sex worker kind of starts giving him a hand job in the restaurant. And it's sort of played for laughs, but at the same time, it's really dark and horrible because this poor woman is so, she just looks so traumatized and upset by everything she's being put through. But at the same time, it's almost like this sort of knockabout comedy scene. And that's the stuff that I think the film doesn't do very well. Even though there is something really interesting in this, like you say, that conversation that you just played, there's something really fascinating in exploring this idea of these two really, you know, privileged, good-looking dudes who are just like, you know, have this kind of weird narcissism or God complex about them that are basically sociopaths, particularly James. But yeah, I think ultimately all it comes to is to make him a red herring because you think he's going to be the killer. I think that's it, really, isn't it?
You know? That is the thing. Like, they had the opportunity to kind of explore these deeper things and like... But they missed the mark on it. But that scene you just talked about, thing that really gets me with that as well is afterwards when James is like goading the sex worker into like saying, I'll give you $150 if you can, you can say I love you and make me believe it. And it just makes you feel dirty as an audience. And it's like any titters of laughter that scene beforehand could have got. And I know in the original cut of the film as well, that scene was longer, like more graphic as well. So I don't know, like, I imagine that hit the chopping block because they're like, oh, we want to keep this, like, want to keep the rating down and get as many eyes on it. But like, I think like sometimes showing people the real darkness and stuff can make more of like an impact and kind of those showing them as more negative people. I know it's that thing of you want somebody to like, but I think what this film cleverly does is it kind of in the final act, as much as Martin is the kind of conduit for the audience, is Patricia Arquette very much gets framed like throughout the film as like a final girl, at least in that archetype, but like with that sequence of her sneaking into Joyce's apartment and her kind of getting the moment where she's like crawling across broken glass to try and like get the fire alarm. It's like, oh great, like, again, I wish that Patricia Arquette somewhat got to do a bit more, because most of the film she's kind of sidelined to just like whine and whimper and just like be subject to Martin's ill behavior. And what do you think of Patricia Arquette's performance in what she gets to do?
Well, I hate to say it, but I don't think it's her best performance. I don't think any of them are giving their best performances in this film. I think actually Josh Brolin is doing a really good job, actually, as James. He's good. He's genuinely chilling and horrible. I think Ewan McGregor and Patricia Arquette, who we know are really good actors, are not quite at their best in this movie, and I can only assume that's down to the directing more than anything. It's a little bit flat and a little bit one note, I think, from both of them particularly. And Patricia Arquette, like you said, has quite little to work with for the bulk of the movie. She is this sort of slightly sort of put upon girlfriend, really, and that's sort of it. And then she does, like you say, she sort of becomes the final girl at the end, and she gets some quite good moments, but really all she gets to do is sort of scream and cry, even as the sort of final girl character. And you're kind of rooting for her, and there's that quite tense moment when she goes into the flat of the sex worker and finds her dead, and the killer is right there in the bathroom next to her, and it's quite a good scary moment, and you're really kind of rooting for her at that moment as our sort of heroine. But she doesn't get a whole lot to do, does she? Let's be honest. It's a shame, you know.
It is a real shame, and like, you can only hope that, yeah, if I don't know. What, it's got to be 25 years since this film came out?
Yeah.
Somebody might dig up that original cut and maybe slip it out on home media. That would like make, yeah, hopefully we'll be having this conversation again, the Redux.
We know how good she is, right? I mean, she's won an Oscar since for Boyhood. She was amazing even before this in True Romance. I mean, even in Dream Warriors, she has a more nuanced, layered character than she does in this film, I think, you know, which is a bit of a shame.
Well, and in the same year as well, she's in Lost Highway, which, like,
yeah,
again, amazing. she doesn't really get to say much, but like, she gets to just act and kind of, like, do you know what I mean, like,
yeah,
she's a physical presence and kind of is utilized, or, do you know what I mean, David Lynch knows who and what Patricia Arquette is and kind of utilizes,
yeah,
her.
And I think, like, yeah, that film is in some ways is a really interesting companion. I think it's a sort of better example of a movie about fragile men, right?
Yes.
And men's psyches and male paranoia, and that Patricia Arquette's character is really framed right in the center of that kind of slightly weird, surreal, Lynchian subjective view of who is this woman. Is she some sort of temptress? Is she some sort of femme fatale? Is she just an innocent victim? And she gets to play all of those roles in Lost Highway, which is so good. Like you say, he kind of cast her and got her to really play to her strengths in that movie, I think. Yeah,
whereas this, she's kind of sidelined to just, yeah, like, scream.
Yeah, the film is definitely much more interested in the men in this film. You know, it really is. And that's why it's a shame that some of those explorations of what it means to be a man in this world aren't quite there, you know, aren't quite on point.
Definitely. So, yeah, let's talk about the casting of Nick Nolte. And I'm not sure about you, but, like, even, like, rewatching this, it's been a long time since first watching it, you kind of pick up, you go, oh, it's Nick Nolte, of course he's gonna be, he's sinister, he's got a sinister edge to him.
he just grunts his way through, doesn't he? Oh yeah, he's great, isn't he, in this. So, like, I really, you know, he's one of those people a bit like Brad Dourif as well. It's like every time he steps onto screen in this film, you go, oh, okay, amazing. Like, he's got a bit of weight about him, and his role is quite ridiculous, particularly in the last act. Like, he go, you know, it's quite silly what he does. But actually, I think he does a really good job. I think he's much better in this than Ewan McGregor. I think he has a bit of gravitas, and I don't know, something about him and his presence in this movie sort of worked for me. I really liked him in it.
So what do you think of the kind of the reveal and the kind of, yeah, the plot that obviously Nick Nolte is this disgraced night watchman who we get whispers of, right? You kind of, that really, I think a really effective sequence in this is that first time that Martin is shown round the morgue, and like, from the kind of the set design and there's some great camera work in this. There's a lot of like kind of low, long shots and stuff like that, and these kind of like pans into people and like a lot of uses of eyes and stuff like that. But yeah, what do you think of the kind of plot machinations that turn out that Nick Nolte's character, Inspector Cray, is the
killer. Yeah, I kind of like it, and I agree with you. I think that stuff in the morgue, you really only see him in the morgue, like he only, you know, because he comes in and out during the night shift, doesn't he? And you know, all of those scenes are my favourite scenes, like I said, and I totally agree with you. Those amazing kind of camera movements. It's quite over the top. Yes. Again, it's quite Italian, but there is something about those kind of like those pans and those tracking shots and those dolly zooms with these kind of strings, you know, every time they enter a new scary room or something. And yeah, in terms of Nick Nolte's character and his motivations, it's kind of, there is something, again, really interesting there at the heart of it, that he was this disgraced mortician who had had sex with the dead bodies, and the morgue was too ashamed to sort of prosecute and go public. So they just sort of quietly let him go, and he's still out there. And now he's become this police officer who is investigating these murders that he is committing. There's this interesting thing where he talks about the killer. And is he actually making a confession? Is he talking about himself, or is he just making it up? But he sort of says, I think this killer wants to stop. I think he wants to put an end to what he's doing. And he's trying to, but he can't stop himself. So he's trying to figure out a way to do that. And by framing somebody and putting somebody else away for it, it means that he will have to stop what he's doing. He essentially says that to Martin through the film, doesn't he? And
yeah,
is that actually his MO? Like, do we think that he is, you know, he's this sexual deviant, basically, that can't stop what he's doing, but he wants to stop? Or is that all just complete nonsense, and is he just making that up to fool Martin, and is he really enjoying what he's doing, and will he continue enjoying what he's doing? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because yeah, there are moments where basically he tells, like, and it's quite interesting on rewatch, because he tells Martin like what he's going to do next, basically.
Yeah.
He's like, he's found somebody who's close to it, and there's all he was looking for was a link to Joyce, that he can kind of like have that link, so he will be able to frame that person. And he's like, he might as well say, Martin, you're gonna go down for this. It's kind of, as an audience, like, on rewatch, you rewatch it and go, oh yeah, like he of course he's the killer.
He's sort of slowly setting up all the chess pieces from the start, isn't he? But you kind of want to believe at the beginning, he kind of feels like quite an ally. He feels like quite a nice guy and somebody who Martin kind of quite enjoys being in his company, right, at the beginning. But yeah, if he is this psychopath, he's a very self-aware psychopath, right? He's very... He seems to be very aware of his own psychosis and what his MO is. And, you know, when he's playing the role of the police officer, he's very good at kind of explaining what this serial killer is all about, which is quite funny, you know. And again, it feels very Thomas Harris. It feels very Silence of the Lambs, this idea of Hannibal Lecter kind of explaining how this serial killer's mind works. And even all that stuff towards the end of him, of Martin kind of uncovering who the killer is by going through all the files and finding all the old Night Watchman stuff. It feels a bit like you're watching Red Dragon or Silence of the Lambs or something. It feels a little bit half-baked in this movie compared to some of those others. But I generally enjoyed Nick Nolte. I thought he was good in the bulk of the film, and I kind of enjoy his killer reveal at the end and then him going full nuts with Patricia Arquette in the final act, you know?
Well, yeah, because the film obviously does that thing where the audience are ahead of the characters in the film, because we get the reveal when Nick Nolte comes out of the bathroom in Joyce's apartment once he's killed her, and then obviously Patricia Arquette's Catherine hasn't seen like a name written on a piece of paper. And then obviously, like, that's kind of one of the pieces, coupled with the fact that, again, it feels like it's just written in to kind of be able to reveal who the killer is, when they're like, James has just has been seeing Joyce but saying he's Martin, and Martin must pretend he's James for some reason. And then that's kind of like the smoking gun that puts doubt in everyone's mind and kind of gets everybody kind of on the same page to be like, something's not right with Inspector Cray right now.
And John C. Reilly starts to get suspicious, doesn't he? It's great. I mean, all of that is quite funny. And again, there is something there. If I'm giving the film lots of credit, I mean, there is a really interesting parallel between Martin and Inspector Cray, right? That it's kind of building up this idea that they are similar, that they're parallel, that they both have this weird God complex. They both kind of think of themselves as better than women, mm-hmm. and that they can do what they want with women. And I think Martin is almost like dipping his toe in that world with what he's doing with James, but he's resisting it. And it's almost like Nick Nolte's character is like, that's the path that he could end up going down if he's not careful, almost, you know. It's kind of interesting, you know.
And it feels like there's a version of this film as well where like James could almost be like the, because a lot of the conversations they have, it's just the two of them, like,
yeah.
And it's almost like there could be some kind of theory or at least like they're just projections of Martin's mind, kind of like,
yeah,
him trying to rationale like what he's doing. And like there could be an interesting version of a film like this where it is somebody trying to grapple with maybe they are the killer and they're kind of the dissociative, like,
that's so true. Yeah, it's almost like a Fight Club-esque kind of story, I suppose. I mean, it could be, couldn't it? Yeah, you're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If it was kind of handled, in different hands, I think that would have been like the reveal that it was Martin all along, especially in that kind of Mike Flanagan version you kind of pitched earlier, with like just him in the morgue. Like you could imagine telephone calls or at least like his friend coming to visit, and then it is that kind of psychological thing of like, is that guy real, like what is
a bit like Secret Window and those types of movies. It's true. And like in some ways, you know, Josh Brolin's character James, he's like the better looking, more confident, more self-assured version of Martin, isn't he, throughout, which is a very Ed Norton, Tyler Durden kind of dynamic in a way. Yeah. It's a good shout.
I find that really fascinating. So how do you think this fits into that kind of stable of Dimension Films like roster?
Oh, like perfectly. Because you like when you look at the other Dimension films from the 90s, you've got, you know, The Faculty, you've got Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer, like all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, you've got everything from your opening kill down to your murder mystery whodunit to your glossy, good-looking cast to it not making a whole lot of sense, but doesn't really matter, to that mix of kind of classic horror with a hip 90s soundtrack, like you say, those kind of needle drops. Like these are all like quintessential Dimension Films 90s horror kind of traits. So they look a bit jarring and dated at times these days, I think, but it was such a thing at the time, you know. It was always trying to be sort of gruesome and scary, but also really cool and trendy, you know. And that's like, that is exactly what it feels like this film is trying to do. Like you said earlier, even listening to the trailer, you'll get a sense of that. That is what that vibe is, isn't it?
And it very much looks like Josh Brolin maybe had like a two-picture deal with them, because I think he filmed this and Mimic back to back.
Definitely. Yeah,
If you watch some of like the later sequences in the film, Josh Brolin has slightly longer hair because they kind of came back for reshoots. And he's got his Mimic hair, like when they're kind of like wrapping the film up. So it's I love that kind of stuff where it's like, shit, we need to give it that classic. And it very much does feel like that really big in the 90s as well. They kind of saw that it was a thing in the 80s, and it's like every film had to have it, where the film ends with the protagonist kind of coming out of the murder house or wherever the murders have taken place in a blanket. There's just loads of cops, there's helicopters in this one for some reason, there's an ambulance, and they kind of just get that like those, again, you get a very weird conversation between James and Martin where he says to him, and I've got it written down here because I don't want to misquote it, because I found it quite bizarre, where he says to him like, let's grow old together. And it like, I was like, it kind of leaves like a bit of, I don't know what that sentiment is supposed to mean. Have you got like a
they're just like best buds, aren't they? Slash, there's something quite maybe almost homoerotic about this relationship right from the start, like the way that they kind of egg each other on to sleep with like the sex workers, the way that James kind of wants to watch while his mate gets a hand job and stuff. Like there is something there too, almost, that these two men really are in love with each other as well, I think, you know. But it's weird, it's a bit messy, that final conversation. And again, you kind of end up almost wanting to go, like, it's almost like the film wants you to go, oh, you know, they're nice guys, really, I'm glad they survived, kind of thing. And it's like, well, they're not.
Well, yeah, I think I was left thinking, like, oh, so James is definitely going to end up murdering some people. Like, do you know what I mean? Or
yeah,
he's going to do some bad shit eventually. How do you, like, because watching it this time, and I guess it's a problem I have with the film, is that whole kind of end sequence, everything, like, from the reveal of Nick Nolte feels massively rushed.
It does feel a bit rushed, yeah. And it has to, like, tick a lot of boxes. It has to get from A to B to C. Like, they've got to get to the morgue to, you know, Patricia Arquette's got to think that Ewan McGregor's the killer for a moment, so he's got to get locked in the room, and then they go off and they do this thing, and they go off in a room together, and then they get attacked. And yeah, it does. Again, it feels like there was probably at some point a longer cut of this. There was potential to have a really great, really scary final act in that morgue, right, with these characters being stalked by this killer. And it does feel like a bit of a missed opportunity in that regard, where you end up with Martin and Patricia Arquette's character just, like, crying and screaming tied up on, like, a gurney together, basically, for, like, quite a lot of that last act. And then it's just, like you say, then it's just sort of over, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And there's some real, like, kind of lapses in logic, which I guess you find in a lot of horror movies, where it's like, so Patricia Arquette has left Inspector Bill at her apartment, taken her bike, like, gone on her own to the morgue, like, even, like, and she knows that the killer is out there. She knows that the killer is probably closer than she thinks he is. Like, there's been seeds of doubt in everyone's mind that it could be Martin as well. Yet she goes anyway. And it's like that's weird, bizarre, like.
You're right. Like, the whole the moment from when she goes into that flat, sees the dead body, and then nearly sees the killer onwards, it's like, I don't really understand any of her actions post that moment. Like, she doesn't tell the police. She goes back and tells her mates about it. And then it's not till later when the police are interviewing her and she was like, oh, I was in the flat earlier when he was in there. And they're like, what? It's all a bit weird and doesn't really make any sense from that point, does it?
Yeah, because it's like, there wasn't a name. There wasn't a name. Yeah. I was in the apartment. It's like, whoa. They're like, to quote The Wedding Singer, that information would have been useful yesterday. Yeah. Like,
yeah, exactly. It's so true. Yeah, it's all a bit of a nonsense, isn't it, in that final act? It's true. It's like they had to kind of come up with something. You know, again, you get this big Dimension Films-esque, you get this, it's almost like they're going for this Scream-esque killer reveal and this big final act with this big bloodbath and this big struggle, but it doesn't quite manage it, does it, really? Yeah, which is a shame.
Yeah, I think they kind of missed the mark on what the Scream franchise, like, does really well is the killer reveal is the same for the audience as it is for the characters. So obviously I think the tension, like, the wind is taken out of the sails of it in that final act, because we know who the killer is. And I guess there is an element of that bomb under the table thing, like, when's the bomb going to blow? But at the same time, it's like, it could be played so much differently. Do you know what I mean? That kind of tussle between Martin and Craig could be about something else. It could just be, like, frustrations of, like, Martin is professing his innocence and kind of ends up getting in a tussle with him, and that's when Patricia Arquette comes in and stuff like that. And, like,
yeah it's true. And also, what's with this old man, he played one, like, theme tune that accompanies the killer, right? And then when the killer decides to reveal himself to Patricia Arquette, don't know why he does that, he decides to reveal himself, he does it by whistling that tune as well. It's like, what? Yeah. Again, that feels like it was made for us for that moment more than it was as part of the story, you know? It's like, what? That makes no sense at all, none of that.
Yeah, it feels like they're like, Nightmare on Elm Street's got one, two, Freddy's coming for you. It's like, we need, do you know what I mean? Like, everyone's got their kind of theme or something, or, like,
we need something.
We need a hook. That final act, it feels like there's a lot of, like, missed opportunities and, like, kind of, I'm not sure if it plays out like that in the original. I can imagine it possibly does. Like,
I remember it being more gruesome and darker and scarier in a way, but also I don't remember the story beats being that different. I think it does happen fairly similarly to that. But yeah, it's been a while since I've seen the Danish version, to be fair. But I also just love that idea that at the end, when you, like you said, you see those two, the two lead guys like wrapped in blankets at the end, you know, like these kind of final boys almost in this movie. And I was just thinking, watching it last night, I was like, this is Obi-Wan Kenobi and Thanos just like huddled together in the back of an ambulance at this point, you know, hilarious.
Oh, that's perfect. So yeah, and like what one of the things I kind of, just to draw it to like another a horror film kind of, in a way, this, there's like a weird, it feels like James Wan might have watched this like when conceiving of Saw, because there's like, just through some of the visuals and that kind of,
yes,
the look of the morgue and stuff like that, and the kind of final act, like sawing off your own thumb to get out of a trap to kind of take the killer down, feels very Saw-esque.
It's true. It's so true. Yeah, even that kind of nursery rhyme song that accompanies the killer, there's almost something of that kind of dummy puppet in Saw to that as well, isn't there? Yeah, maybe you're right. I reckon ultimately it all comes back to Seven. I mean, like, one of the big inspirations for Saw was definitely David Fincher's Seven. And even though it didn't quite have that level of gore in Seven, there was a lot of that in the on the periphery, right? That these detectives would come across this kind of scene of this crime where they would work out, oh, this woman had to either slice off her own face or she would be killed, or this person had to do, you know, was force fed or else he would be killed. Like, these kind of horrible situations that those victims were put in Seven almost were a bit like traps, and we didn't see them so much. And then Saw kind of upped the ante by sort of saying, well, let's actually show what happens when these characters get put through these tests. So I think ultimately they probably all owe a debt to Seven, really. Yeah, but you're right, like, some of those visuals and camera movements, you know, they are quite similar to Saw actually as well. Like, the camera is just like all over the place in this film in the same way that it is in Saw, which is true.
I just pulled that out because I was like, I'm trying to look for something now in this film to give it a bit more credit than it's
it's big and operatic in the way that James Wan movies are all big and operatic. Like, yes, rooms seem to be much vaster than they should be, and there's this big orchestral score, and there's jump scares, and there's shadows and flickering lights, and that's all such a James Wan thing, and that is all in this film, to be fair. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, like that morgue, it's like, why are those lights flickering? And I love that.
Why is this morgue designed like this? Like, it's ridiculous.
And there's that motif throughout the film as well, where it keeps going back to a shot of like a light fixture with like moths kind of like rattling around inside. And when we get to the third act, they're all dead. And it's like, oh, like that. I love that as kind of like visual kind of something to hold on to, like, I'd be like, oh, really? I don't know.
Yeah,
creeps up.
I love it. I really do. I think honestly, everything about the stuff that happens at night in the morgue is so good in this film. It's just the other stuff that is just a bit all over the place. But yeah, the production design, like we've talked about, the bin bags, the trees, the wind, the darkness, the flickering lights, the moths. There's that weird Polaroid picture of this man on death row that's just on the wall, like a black and white photo that's really creepy. Like, I think all of that is just great. It's just like really good horror window dressing and builds a real atmosphere, doesn't it? It's so good.
And then the film like introduces the on-duty doctor, who is played by horror icon Brad Dourif. I just wanted to play a clip of his kind of introduction to the film.
Have you ever spent any time with the Zine family?
What?
Thorazine, Stelazine, Compazine?
No.
They're really very nice. They will make you sing hymns while you watch a baby fall under a train.
No, thank you. I'm fine. Thanks.
What are your opinions on Brad Dourif's kind of batshittery in this film, kind of coming in now and then, kind of being menacing, basically?
Well, it sort of feels like a 90s dimension film type thing, where we know We know it's Brad Dourif. They know it's Brad Dourif. Like, he doesn't really need to be there. He doesn't really act like a human being acts. Like, he comes in and he's quite menacing and over the top and quite nasty, and then he leaves again, right? And that just happens a few times. And it feels like one of those 90s, like, let's put some horror royalty in as a cameo part kind of thing, doesn't it? And I mean, I don't mind that. I think it's quite fun. I quite enjoy seeing him pop up every now and then. And he is genuinely quite a horrible, you know, presence in this film, adds to the weird atmosphere.
If I've got this right, there's a moment where Martin calls him up and kind of calls him out and kind of says that he's the killer. Like,
yeah, I guess he's also a suspect in this too, isn't he? Really, you know, because he's this very unhinged, like seemingly unhinged doctor who always seems to be around at these moments when something bad happens in the morgue. So I guess it also adds to that list of possible suspects, doesn't it, as well? Yeah,
definitely. So as we start to wind things down, how do you think this works in regards to scares? Are there any particular scares in this film?
I really do think this movie does a good job with scares. I think you know, from that first night shift where he's by himself, he's, you know, the wind is whistling. There's a moment when he's looking at the red light thinking, please don't go off. And then suddenly his buzzer is like buzzer timer goes off to say he's got to do the rounds. Like, I think that's a good jump scare. There's a moment when he's he's kind of got a bit more comfortable, and there's like almost like a montage to some 90s music as he's skateboarding. He's like wheeling around on a chair in the morgue. He's having fun. And then suddenly he turns around and there's like a body's been moved, and there's like this trail of blood going out the door, and suddenly all of the music stops and these like strings kick in. When he sees this kind of body placed at the end of a corridor, I think all those scares genuinely work really well. I really like all that stuff. I think that's where it really works for me. Yeah,
I think what this film manages to capture, especially in those morgue sequences, is an element of like that a fear of like places. Do you know what I mean? Whether it's like, sometimes it can be a familiar place. Like, I'm not sure how you are, but like sometimes when like people, yeah, like when I'm left in the house on my own, all of a sudden, like something that I'm so familiar of, like just becomes scary all of a sudden. Like the kind of the noises upstairs. And like, obviously this takes it to the nth degree by like going, well, morgues are inherently quite a scary, do you know what I mean? The spectre of death is looming constantly. Yeah. But like, I find it interesting the way that it kind of takes just how a place can be quite terrifying.
I completely agree with you. There's something really relatable about those human moments of fear at the beginning where he puts on the radio in his little office and he's like, okay, the radio helps, and he's kind of starts to relax a bit, and then he suddenly thinks he hears something and he turns off the music and he just sits there quietly for a moment just listening to see if he really did hear something or if his mind is playing tricks on him. And like, that is a very real moment. I feel like I've done that a million times, like where I'll be alone in the house watching TV, I think I've heard something, I'll press mute on whatever I'm watching or listening to, and I'll just sit there for like silently for a moment being like, did I hear something? Was there something there, you know? And that is the kind of fear that we all have, that horror movies at their best really tap into, I think. And this movie does genuinely, for all its flaws, it does have those real moments of true fear, I think. And that, like you say, that sense of place. And it's something that The Shining does really well, which is make something uncanny and scary out of big spaces. And I think that space where he sits in his office and it's glass and he looks out to that huge kind of hallway that seems to just kind of disappear into infinity, that is Into the Darkness. That's just a great production design and a great set, I think, because it really does feel like anybody could be out there lurking in the dark watching him, you know?
Definitely. I often like record in this, well, I record all the time in the shed, but sometimes I'll be late nights editing episodes and stuff like that, to your point of like frightening yourself. So I'll have I have a lamp on, and then I've had it many a times where like I just catch my shadow out of the corner of my eye, and like I'm terrified. I'm like, because it feels like I'm like somebody's all of a sudden in here. And like, yeah, I think this film manages to capture that fear that you manage to, it's almost self-imposed. And I think The Shining, I think this film, not a massive debt, but it's definitely, I guess, like, especially in the 90s after that film coming out in 1980, it looms heavy over horror from then on out, right? And it's kind of, even if it's Nick Nolte, like, going down the halls of the morgue with a baseball bat, like, it's kind of reminiscent to the axe wielding of the finale of The Shining. So, right. As we wrap this up, one of the things I like to always do on this podcast is see if there was any Coppola connections in the film. So are there people who worked in this film or are in this film or worked on it that have worked with the Coppolas elsewhere in their career? Did you manage to find any, Mike?
Oh, God. Do you know what? That is a good question. I'm so unprepared for this, and I'm trying to think now if there are any. I mean, there must be, right? Because these are all huge stars. Josh Brolin, Ewan McGregor. They must have been in other movies with other members of the family, right?
There's not as many as you'd think. I'll just rattle off a few.
Go on.
So Nick Nolte is in Life Lessons, a short directed by Martin Scorsese, which is a part of an anthology called New York Stories, which has a short by Francis Ford Coppola. Josh Brolin in 1996 is in the film Flirting with Disaster, which also Patricia Arquette was in, where he plays her bisexual ex-partner who gets caught licking her armpit at one point in the film. So that's if you want to see Josh Brolin licking Patricia Arquette's armpit, seek that one out. I like this one because Scott Buckholder, who is just accredited as college professor in this film, has a role in both Con Air and Gone in 60 Seconds. And you can kind of tell the career he's had because both credits are Con Air is air traffic controller and Gone in 60 Seconds is rent-a-cop. So very much small time roles every time. But you got to get those guys who do it. And Brad Dourif as well has worked twice with Nicolas Cage. One in 1993 with Amos and Andrew, where he plays Ned Schoonholtz. And in Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans,
That's a good one. Yeah, I love that film.
So all roads lead back to Nicolas Cage a lot of the time on this.
There you go.
Is there anything in the film that you wanted to mention, Mike, that we didn't at all?
I don't think so. No, I think we pretty much covered it all, didn't we? It's a weird film, and it's a film that sort of feels like it's been forgotten. But I think there's a lot to appreciate in this, especially from a horror perspective. You know, there's some genuinely good moments of horror in this movie.
Yeah, I think it's definitely kind of an article of the time, right? It's kind of dealing with that post-Seven. It's got that Dimensions film aspect to it. And it's also got like a element of like, that post-Tarantino world that it was made in as well, where it's kind of the killer's like quite self-referential. The main characters are having pop culture conversations about stuff, and a connection to Tarantino as well. This film was edited by Sally Menke, longtime, now departed like editor who kind of did all of his stuff basically.
Shout
outs to Sally Menke. This is edited well, at least. I mean, there's some good cuts in
it. It absolutely is. So true.
So let's get on to rating this film, Mike. And the way we do it on this podcast is I always ask my guests, what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film?
Oh my God. Does it have to be wine itself, or could it just be anything that you'd pair with this?
We're always up for breaking the rules on this podcast, so pair us with something.
I mean, if it was wine, it would be something quite cheap, right? But I was thinking like you'd want like a sort of cheap vodka, almost like the thing that poor woman has to down in the restaurant, like something that maybe does the job but makes you feel a bit sick and dirty afterwards. I feel like it would be something quite cheap and low rent, you know?
Yeah, I think you can get that from some red wines as well. And I think
Pairing
it to a red wine is that aspect of the film thinks it's very serious. Do you know what I mean? And people who drink red wine kind of go, oh, I'm a serious guy. I'm a serious person right now. I'm on the red wine, where it's like, if anything, afterwards, you just feel a bit like, do you know what I mean? Your mouth's claggy and you feel a bit dirty. And I think that's
exactly
an aspect of this film. You get that. You kind of feel a bit like, I got a bit of a headache from all that sugar music and the high strings.
You're just left feeling a bit like, it kind of like the feeling after you've had a McDonald's or something. You're like, well, that was kind of, I thought I wanted that, but now that it's done, I'm not sure if I feel that good about it. Do you know what I mean?
That's perfect. I think that is basically Dimension Films all over. At least like 90% of their output.
Yeah, it's so true.
Cinematic fast food. Amazing. So with your pairing, is that a bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf? AKA, is this film any good?
It's firmly in the middle shelf for me, because I think that there are some scenes that are top shelf horror, and then there is some stuff that is absolute straight to video bottom shelf drivel, you know, and it's a real mix from scene to scene as to what you're gonna get, you know. So I'd put it firmly in the middle.
Yeah, bit of a punch, bit of a kind of, yeah, like, you're drinking what your parents have got left. They've got £100 bottle of wine, and they've also got a box wine.
So exactly, we're mixing
them up tonight.
Perfect. Exactly that.
Perfect. Well, I like to end the podcast by asking some impossible questions, and the first of all being, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the entire filmography of the rest of the family?
Oh. I mean, I think I've got to say Francis Ford Coppola. I'm a big fan of some of his big early masterworks, and I even love Bram Stoker's Dracula. Yes. And I think, what would cinema be without The Godfather and some of those others from the 70s, you know? So I think I'm being basic, but I'd say it has to be the Godfather of the Coppola family himself, you know?
Yeah. I've said it before on this podcast, and I'll probably say it again, but like, there is a big argument that it's kind of cinema as we know it doesn't exist without Francis Ford Coppola. He's kind of, I know that George Lucas and Steven Spielberg kind of get the monikers of being, they invented the summer blockbuster, but without the kind of success of The Godfather, and as well being like what would have been an R-rated film in America, kind of being such a smash, and the fact that Francis Ford Coppola saw George Lucas wandering around the Warner Brothers like back lot and said, who's this guy who's on this film set who's like under the age of 50? He's got a beard and glasses like myself. Like, I'm going to take this guy under my wing. And then obviously produced American Graffiti for him, and released THX 113 like as well, and kind of gave him the kick up the ass to be like, hey, you should make something. Then 1977, we got Star Wars. Do you know what I mean?
And without that, it's so true.
Without that competitive, without Francis Ford Coppola, I'd say, being like the first one to go over the top as like a director and go, hey, we can be this new generation, the new Hollywood gang, like, we almost don't get those guys. And it's his mark on cinema will probably be outlive him by years and years and years, right?
Definitely. Yeah, he's a giant, isn't he? And even right now, you know, The Godfather, at the moment we're recording this, The Godfather is celebrating its 50th anniversary. There was like a big event for it. It's coming back to cinemas, and people are still kind of discovering and falling in love with those early movies of his as well. So yeah, I think it's got to be him.
Yeah, I was speaking to someone recently who said they had like got tickets to see it at the cinema, because it coincides perfectly with Picture House and Cineworld's cinema day, where they're doing tickets for £3. So they were like, the screening, they just got in like to a screening of The Godfather, and like, who would have thought a film 50 years after it was released, like, people were going to be packing out cinemas for it? It's kind of, as doing what I'm doing, I'm like, amazing. Hopefully when that Godfather episode drops, Like people want to listen.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, Mike, based on Night Watch alone, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
Undoubtedly, absolutely. Hey, Patricia Arquette doesn't get to do much, but she still does her best in this, and yes, they are the greatest family.
Perfect. And on to possibly the most important question of this podcast, and that is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
Oh my god. It's a really good question. I'm trying to think of something really deep and profound, but now all I can think of is like, can I use your bathroom, please? Or something. I have absolutely no idea. God, what a film. I need to go back and revisit that film at some point. But yeah, I don't know. I bet you've got some good answers from people for this one.
Yeah, it depends. It depends when the episode was recorded. At some points, there was a lot of like, I've got a good lawyer just in case you might need one in the future. there's been, yeah. Don't work with Disney has been like one of the answers.
How about I'm really sorry for all of my terrible Wes Anderson films I've made, because not a fan of his more recent Wes Anderson output.
Sorry for letting Wes carry on with his bullshit. Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah, I'm so sorry about The French Dispatch if you have to sit through it, because God, I'd like Bill Murray to apologize to me for that film.
Well, when it comes to the inevitable time I cover that film and I clip out something when I put together all of everybody's answers for that question, that's what I'll be clipping out, Mike. Perfect.
Yeah, perfect. Amazing.
So before I let you go, Mike, it's your time to let us know where people can find you and the podcast.
Thank you very much. Yeah, you can find my podcast, The Evolution of Horror, on all the normal places where you get your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter at Evolution Pod. And you can find me on Twitter as well at The Movie Mike.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Mike, for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Thank you for having me.
There we have it, guys. Another film ticked off of our ever-growing list. And a massive thank you, guys, for listening. Massive thank you to Mike as well for coming on and talking about this little oddity of a film. It was an absolute pleasure to have Mike on the podcast. Somebody who I massively admire and listen to his fantastic podcast. Not only do I enjoy it, but it always kind of gives me the urge to up my game and kind of see what I can do better in a way that I think good art should do anyway, or when people are doing something good, it should really kick you up the arse to do something better, really, right? On that note, I recently saw, and I don't think I've talked to you guys about it on the podcast as of yet, because I think I'd recorded the intro to last episode before I had, or maybe I just forgot to mention it, but I recently had the absolute pleasure of watching The Godfather on the big screen, and it was beautiful. It was an absolute delight to sit there for all 3 hours of Francis Ford Coppola's crime epic. And I don't know why I'm just giving you a little bit of a flavor of my life right now, but next Wednesday, the 16th, I will be treating myself to a nice little early birthday present, because my birthday is the 22nd of March. So on the 16th, did I say? I will be going to watch The Godfather Part 2. All 3.5 hours of it, baby. Treat myself to a nice little everyman experience as well. Nice little nice seats, kind of maybe have a little cocktail before, not too many. I don't want to be using that toilet. But yeah, if you've seen The Godfather, if you've seen Night Watch, or if you think that me and Mike missed anything, don't hesitate to get in touch. Obviously, I'm mentioning The Godfather because that may be coming up on the podcast at some point. Yeah, remember, you can always drop me a little voice note about your thoughts on The Godfather. I'd like to get as many of those as possible. You can send them over to cagedinpod@gmail.com. Or if you want to catch us on the socials, like I said, if me and Mike missed anything or you just want to have a general chit-chat, you can find that all at cagedinpod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd. I'd love to have you there. I'd love to chat with you. I always love chatting with you guys. So yeah, come on over and get involved. As for next week on the podcast, I am joined by Adam Schneider, where we talk about the Alex Ross Perry 2014 film Listen Up, Philip, starring the one, the only, the delightful, but in this case, the absolute arsehole that is Jason Schwartzman. It was a very, very fun chat. We kind of delve into what it is to watch a film with an unlikable protagonist. Is it a good idea? We obviously sort of, there's Wes Anderson kind of chit chat in there. There's comparisons made. It's kind of inevitable with these kind of tales of these, I don't know, slightly unlikable characters. We get into it on that episode. Yeah. Make sure you kind of tune in next week for that one, because it was a lot of fun. So if you enjoyed this episode or any episode of the podcast so far, you can always head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod, where you can become a movie brat bro. At the moment, we are in season one, where we are looking at all of the films of Brian De Palma. Last week's episode would have been my chat with Mark Searby and Matt Brothers, all about De Palma's 1993 film Carlito's Way, the kind of another crime epic. I kind of state the case for that on that episode. And next week on that very same Patreon feed, we will be talking about The Untouchables. Again, another deep dive into the crime genre. And I will be talking to Rich Nelson of the Do You Want to Hurt Me podcast. So yeah, heading over there for as little as $3, I believe, or kind of like £2.50, I think that works out as in the Queen's money. So yeah, head on over there to become a patron. That'd be a lot of fun. If you don't want to give me your money, you can always support the podcast by heading over to Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this right now. Give us a lovely 5-star rating and review. And always, in your reviews, please be sure to let me know what you think Scarlett Johansson says to Bill Murray at the end of Lost in Translation. It's one of my favourite things on the podcast to get the answers to that. And I can't wait to read some of yours. As always, guys, I have been Petrus Patsilivus, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.